Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. Supreme Court season is upon us. Always a joyous time on the podcast. And it began with a win for non-citizens, which I'll get to in just a moment. But a few hours later, well, something truly remarkable happened. As emailed out by Immigrants List, quote, "The Supreme Court announced that it will allow Texas to enforce its draconian state deportation law. While the Fifth Circuit has temporarily reinstated the freeze, Texas has succeeded, at least temporarily, in directly undermining the federal government's authority on immigration," end quote. I'm personally not quite sure how Arizona v. United States doesn't clearly govern here. The majority did not issue an opinion for lifting the temporary injunction. We'll see what happens on the merits of the case later this year. It would be nice to not live in a time where every year the Supreme Court seems poised to change constitutional law as we know it, but here we are. Immigrants List is fighting the fight that will occur in a few months' time in the presidential and congressional elections, and supports elected officials who are forward-thinking on immigration, no matter the political party. Check them out. 2024 is very much upon us. And here are your cases. You know we gotta start with the Supreme Court. First, Wilkinson v. Garland, published by the Supreme Court on March 19th, 2024. Justice Sotomayor delivered the opinion of the court, joined by Justices Kagan, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Justice Jackson concurred. Justice Roberts, Alito, and Thomas dissented. This case is about what exactly circuit courts can review. As myself and many others have been saying, this case is kind of an attempt to explain where the line between recent Supreme Court decisions Guerrero-Lasprilla and Patel fall. Mr. Wilkinson was a respondent in removal proceedings who applied for non-LPR cancellation of removal under INA Section 240A-B. That required that he show, among other things, that his removal would cause exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to his U.S. citizen son, who it so happens, quote, suffers from a serious medical condition, end quote. An immigration judge found Mr. Wilkinson credible, and it appears that it's uncontested that the child suffers from this medical condition. The question, therefore, is, in light of these agreed-upon facts, do these facts rise to the level of exceptional and extremely unusual hardship as the BIA and circuits have defined that term? If that's a factual question, circuits probably can't review it. That's Patel and the jurisdiction-stripping provisions relied upon therein. But if it's a mixed question of law and fact, it's treated like a legal question, and circuits should be able to review it. That's Guerrero-Lasprilla. It's the latter, said the Supreme Court. Quote, the application of a statutory legal standard, like the exceptional and extremely unusual hardship standard, to an established set of facts is a quintessential mixed question of law and fact, end quote. Quintessential! You're making me blush, Justice Sotomayor. There are definitions for this ridiculously sounding, congressionally mandated, exceptional and extremely unusual hardship standard. For example, Matter of Monreal Aguinagua from 2021 recognizes that the standard is more than the ordinary hardship that happens when you make it such that fathers can't live with their children. But on the other hand, that a non-citizen, quote, need not show that such hardship would be unconscionable, end quote. Other precedent requires that immigration judges consider a range of factors, and in the aggregate. So right, it's not the firmest standard in the world, but it's also not a free-for-all. The IJ here applied the facts of the case to the standard and found it lacking. Always interesting to me in cases like this and among other rationales, the IJ reasoned that even without his father's financial and emotional support, the hardship to Mr. Wilkinson's son would be lessened by the availability of public assistance from the U.S. government. Which seems a little bit crazy to me, removing people without criminal convictions and forcing their U.S. citizen children onto welfare and other public programs. The fact that Mr. Wilkinson keeps his son off welfare through his support is not overly important to meeting the hardship standard in cases like this. It's common, right? But the availability of the state to step in with tax dollar money undermines Mr. Wilkinson's ability to establish hardship. I'm not saying it's illogical, I'm just saying that that logic might demonstrate how illogical immigration law can be sometimes. Anyway, the IJ found hardship lacking for this reason and others. End quote. Because he held that Mr. Wilkinson was statutorily ineligible for cancellation of removal, the IJ did not reach determining whether or not to exercise his discretion to grant the application for cancellation. End quote. Something, if adversely decided, Patel would likely have barred review of by the circuit. The BIA affirmed, and the Third Circuit believed that it lacked jurisdiction to review all of it because of Patel. It believed the hardship determination a discretionary finding. But it's not. Well, I mean, it kind of is. It's a mixed question, with just enough law to get Mr. Wilkinson federal court review. Because again, the hardship standard is a legal standard, and application of agreed-upon facts to it becomes a mixed question of law and fact sufficient for review under Gorel-Asprilla. In so holding, and as explained in a footnote at least, the decision would appear to vacate precedent out of at least the 8th, 11th, 5th, 9th, 3rd, and 10th circuits. The 7th, 6th, and 4th circuits got it right. Woot woot! This, of course, despite the fact that non-LPR cancellation of removal is one of the forms of relief expressly listed in the jurisdiction stripping provision at INA Section 242A2B. And while that statute, as interpreted by Patel, might indeed strip courts of jurisdiction over a, quote, judgment, end quote, to deny non-LPR cancellation or the other four forms of relief listed at that statute, Section 242A2D, as in dog, restores jurisdiction to review questions of law. And that's what Guerrero-Asprilla says that this question here is. This is more like Gorel-Asprilla than Patel. Mr. Patel, as we all know, was deemed not credible, and so it was not settled before the 11th Circuit whether he factually intentionally checked that pesky citizenship box on a Georgia driver's license application such that he was inadmissible for making a false claim to U.S. citizenship and therefore ineligible to adjust LPR status, another relief listed at Section 242A2B. For jurisdictional purposes, the 11th Circuit and then a slim Supreme Court majority ruled that as the issues were in dispute, the factual ones, the core claim before the federal court was a factual dispute, which means that Section A2D couldn't save it from Section A2B. This is different. The facts aren't in dispute, only whether the facts satisfy a legal standard. I have a feeling that, like in Santo Zacharia, we'll be seeing this case favorably impact petitions for review for the next year or two in ways that we haven't quite thought of yet. Because, of course, quote, a mixed question may require that courts immerse in case-specific factual issues, compelling them to marshal and weigh evidence. That a mixed question requires a court to immerse itself in facts does not transform the question into one of fact, end quote. And in turn, it would permit circuit court review. It is not the case, explained the court, that circuits need to figure out whether a question presented is primarily factual or primarily legal. No matter the mixture, it appears, circuit review lies. That being said, and at least here, quote, because this mixed question is primarily factual, that review is deferential, end quote. Meh. Quote, the government's counterarguments largely seek to relitigate Guerrero Lasprilla. This court is unpersuaded, end quote. Drop it like it's hot. By the way, Justice Sotomayor does an excellent job of painting a picture of Mr. Wilkinson, his son and his life, the good, the bad, the endearing, and the unfortunate, as so many of these cases entail. Almost never relevant at the Supreme Court level, but good to see recognized by the majority, and if I'm guessing, intentionally so. Justice Sotomayor does, however, unnecessarily state that in other cases, Patel will preclude review of a, quote, IJ's fact-finding on credibility, the seriousness of a family member's medical condition, or the level of financial support a non-citizen currently provides, end quote. Why, Justice? Why? After all, credibility also has a legal standard, as certainly does a medical condition definition. Dicta to fight about another day, says I. But while we're on the topic of dicta, how about this, quote, an IJ applying the exceptional and extremely unusual hardship standard must create an extensive record of his decision-making, including detailed fact-finding and the application of BIA precedent, end quote. I can smell the legal sections on my appeal. Anyway, it means it's getting sent back to the Third Circuit here to decide whether the IJ's application of facts to law was correct. To the concurrence and dissent, briefly. Justice Jackson concurred to remind her colleagues that she might not have signed on to Guerrero Lasprilla if she'd been on the court back then, and she might not agree with it now, but it's the law, and stare decisis still means something. Justice Alito, who dissented in Guerrero Lasprilla, has done so again. Justice Alito counsels against taking, quote, language in the Supreme Court's prior opinions to the outer limits of its possible reach, end quote. And that is Wilkinson v. Garland. Moving on to Gomez-Ruotolo v. Garland, published by the Fourth Circuit on March 20th, 2024. This case is about crimes involving moral turpitude, and it involves children, so heads up. Mr. Gomez-Ruotolo is a native and citizen of Venezuela. I haven't seen a whole lot of these on the pod, that is, Venezuelan cases, but given recent immigration trends and the time it takes for cases to get up to the circuits, I wonder if we'll start seeing more going forward. Time will tell. Anyway, he was brought to the United States at 10 years old with his family in 2001 and became a lawful permanent resident. Pretty much grew up here. But he definitely messed up, and at 18 years old, had his home searched, where authorities found child pornography involving very young children. The conviction was ultimately for, quote, attempting to commit sexual battery on a minor child under the age of 15 years against the will of said minor child by force, threat, or intimidation, or through the use of the child's mental incapacity or physical helplessness in violation of Virginia Code Section 18.2-67.5c, end quote. He received 180 days imprisonment, all suspended, and had to register as a sex offender. At 28 years old, 10 years later, he, quote, posted on Craigslist, stating he desired to get with someone younger, as young as it gets, barely legal, end quote. Not illegal, right? But the undercover detective who responded said they were 14 years old and Mr. Gomez-Ruotolo took the bait. He was indicted for electronic solicitation of a minor between 7 and 14 in violation of Virginia Code Section 18.2-374.3c. He pled guilty and received a mandatory minimum 5 years imprisonment. Afterwards, DHS charged him as removable for having been convicted of two or more CIMTs not arising out of a single scheme, INA Section 237A2AII, and as an LPR convicted of an aggravated felony sexual abuse of a minor. The IJ sustained only the 2CIMT charge and then denied protection under the Convention Against Torture. The BIA affirmed, and so did the Fourth Circuit. Categorical approach applies, which means we need to know the applicable definition of a CIMT. In the Fourth Circuit, the crime must, in all instances, be one that requires, quote, behavior that shocks the public conscience, as being inherently base, vile, or depraved, and that has as an element an intent to achieve an immoral result or willful disregard of an inherent and substantial risk that an immoral act will occur, end quote. Gotta have both those things. Met here. First, the attempting to commit battery on a child younger than 15 crime. For what it's worth, the categorical approach does not permit consideration of the fact that pretty bad images were found at his residence. What matters is what he was convicted of. And it's a large statute, with lots of things included. And actually, it doesn't appear to require a showing that a victim was a minor. Nor might the full statute require that the act was non-consensual. All things that might take it out of being a CIMT. But suffice it to say, the Fourth Circuit deemed the offense divisible as between consensual and non-consensual acts with a minor. But Mr. Gomez-Rotolo's conviction, subsection I, criminalizes the sexual conduct and requires it to be, quote, against the will, end quote, of the victim, and conducted by, quote, force, threat, intimidation, or ruse, end quote. The Fourth Circuit believed it could look to this, that is, just subsection I, because it deemed the full statute divisible as to each subsection. That Mr. Gomez-Rotolo was convicted under subsection I was confirmed by the language used in the criminal indictment to the Fourth Circuit. With the court having so concluded, it rejected Mr. Gomez-Rotolo's argument that the conduct was not always reprehensible. The Fourth Circuit and the BIA, quote, have long considered non-consensual sexual conduct to be morally reprehensible and outrageously offensive, end quote. Dare I say non-consensual sexual conduct rises to the level of persecution when it occurs abroad? Anyway, definitely the case here, as the force required under Virginia case law and jury instructions must be one that overcomes the will of the victim. And to the extent the crime also permits conviction through trickery, well, quote, sexual battery by ruse is also turpitudinous conduct. Crimes that have fraud as an element are categorically crimes involving moral turpitude, end quote. Okay. But technically, Mr. Gomez-Rotolo was only convicted of attempt, not of actually doing it, that first offense. Still a CIMT? Yes. Quote, federal courts uniformly use the underlying substantive offense to determine whether an associated inchoate offense involves moral turpitude, end quote, as has the BIA. Word pronounced correctly. Still need 2 CIMTs to be removable, so it all comes down to electronic solicitation of a minor between 7 and 14 years old, that second offense, which the Fourth Circuit also held is a CIMT. Also a complicated statute, but the argument came down to the fact that it requires that the defendant, quote, knows or has reason to believe that the victim is a child younger than 15 years of age, end quote. So you need not actually know, argued Mr. Gomez-Rotolo. Problem is that the BIA permits a CIMT finding where the statute requires something like this, that the perpetrator should have known that the victim was a child. Should have known is close enough to reason to believe, as this statute requires, for the Fourth Circuit. Not only that, but this statute requires other bad culpable stuff. It's a CIMT, said the court. Removable, and possibly with crimes deemed particularly serious, the Fourth Circuit affirmed denial of cat protection as well. Mr. Gomez-Rotolo was apparently not, quote, an outspoken critic of the Venezuelan government, end quote. And to the Fourth Circuit, his longtime residence in the United States wasn't enough for a claim that the Maduro regime was more likely than not to torture him if he returns. Notwithstanding the possible, quote, pattern of human rights violations, end quote, in that country. Which means Mr. Gomez-Rotolo may get removed if we're removing people to Venezuela. Got my crimmigration brain moving, though. In the Supreme Court's United States v. Taylor decision, episode 113, the court held that attempted Hobbs Act robbery is not a crime of violence, even though Hobbs Act robbery is. And that was because attempt doesn't require the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force, as the completed Hobbs Act robbery offense would. I get that CIMTs are different than crimes of violence, but why is the analysis? Why, as reasoned in this case with the first crime, do the elements of an attempt conviction match the definition of a CIMT simply because the completed offense matches the definition of a CIMT, when that is not necessarily the case with crimes of violence? Just a thought. Dare I say Taylor may have implicitly overruled some long-held beliefs about how the categorical approach works? Or maybe attempted Hobbs Act robbery and the crime of violence inquiry are just sui generis. And that is Gomez-Ruotolo v. Garland. Next up is Sebastian Andres v. Garland, published by the Sixth Circuit on March 20th, 2024. This case is about nexus. Ms. Sebastian Andres is an asylum seeker and indigenous woman from Guatemala. Namely, she is, quote, Mayan Acateco, end quote. As a teenager, a gang member named Pedro said that she had become, quote, his woman, end quote, and threatened rape and other physical abuse if she did not do so. He began stalking her. Her parents said she needed to flee to the United States. She, quote, felt especially concerned about Pedro's threats and constant surveillance because she and her family, who speak their indigenous language rather than Spanish, could barely communicate with the Spanish-speaking police, end quote. Plus, Ms. Sebastian Andres believes that police collaborate with the gangs. She fled 5 months after it all began and brought an asylum claim in immigration court. But the IJ didn't believe that what happened to her was bad enough to be past persecution, or that it was because she was an indigenous woman. Also, the IJ believed she hadn't shown that she couldn't relocate within Guatemala. The BIA affirmed only on one ground: Ms. Sebastian Andres hadn't shown that her experience and fears in Guatemala were on account of her being a Mayan Acateco woman. Convention Against Torture protection denied, too. The Sixth Circuit affirmed. It, too, didn't see a nexus between Ms. Sebastian Andres being a Mayan Acateco woman and Pedro's actions. Most fatally to the Sixth Circuit, Ms. Sebastian Andres testified, when asked during a brief colloquy by the IJ, that Pedro, too, was indigenous and that she did not believe he had threatened her because she was, too, but rather simply because he wanted her to be his wife. Now, just because Pedro wanted a wife doesn't necessarily doom her claim, explained the court. Nice quote from mixed motive cases in the Sixth Circuit, quote, even if the BIA identifies one likely reason for the persecution that has nothing to do with the protected characteristic, it is still required to consider all the evidence in the record to evaluate whether a nexus exists, end quote. But here, Ms. Sebastian Andres didn't really present sufficient evidence of another reason other than being forced into matrimony. She didn't connect the dots, explained the Sixth Circuit. Might have a claim on a more developed record in a future case, though, quote, because Ms. Sebastian Andres did not testify that her inability to communicate with the police caused Pedro to target her, we cannot speculate that such a situation was at play here, end quote, and I guess may be viable, if it was. This despite country condition record evidence showing that indigenous women in Guatemala do face disproportionate barriers to justice and that they're at increased risk of violence. The BIA wasn't so wrong on asylum to warrant reversal. Well, what about withholding of removal? As begrudgingly recognized by a different Sixth Circuit panel last week, the nexus standard for withholding is easier to meet in the Sixth Circuit than it is for asylum. A protected ground need only be a reason for the harm feared or suffered. That's Guzman-Vasquez v. Barr, Episode 4 from 2020. Well, quote, the IJ issued her decision before we announced the difference between the two standards, so she did not have the opportunity to consider how the difference might affect Ms. Sebastian Andres' case. Ms. Sebastian Andres says this amounts to reversible error, but the BIA, writing 4 years after the IJ, applied the correct standard, end quote. But isn't nexus a finding of fact? Is it? That is the reason something happened? Maybe not. I know there's been decisions recently. Maybe it's a mixed question? I really can't recall offhand at the moment. Interesting to research, and maybe even circuit by circuit specific. Anyway, cat denial was affirmed too. No nexus required, of course, but there must be a strong government connection to succeed. And quote, if the applicant never contacted any officials, we usually treat this as a signal that the government did not turn a willfully blind eye to the applicant, end quote, as would be required to succeed on a cat claim. In light of the no reporting here, Ms. Sebastian Andreas would need to come forth with a lot of evidence to show that the government consented or acquiesced or was willfully blind to Pedro and the other harms she feared, unmet to the court. Or that is to say, the BIA wasn't necessarily wrong. Quote, there are effectively two narratives about state action that emerge from all this evidence. But our task is not to pick the version that we believe is more convincing. Instead, we evaluate whether the version articulated by the BIA and the IJ was supported by reasonable, substantial, and probative evidence. Here it was, end quote. That's how it can go with circuit court review. And that is Sebastian Andreas v. Garland. Next is Ferreira v. Garland, published by the First Circuit on March 21st, 2024. It's a win for the non-citizen by none other than ACLU New Hampshire. You guys are kind of a thing. This case is about particular social groups and what the BIA is and is not allowed to do on appeal. Ms. Ferreira is a 61-year-old citizen of Trinidad and Tobago. As a child, she was sexually abused by her uncle for years, who threatened that he'd kill her mother if she didn't comply. It was horrifying stuff. She ran away after years of it at 15 years old, and she never told police. She never saw or spoke to the uncle again, although she came to learn that he had asked about her a few times. Indeed, decades later in 2018, the uncle asked Miss Ferreira's mother about Miss Ferreira. When the mother returned to Trinidad to sell a property. The mother lied and said she didn't know where Miss Ferreira was. During that trip, it appears that, quote, the uncle, accompanied by three or four other men, accosted the mother at her property and attempted to rob her. The men tied the mother to a chair for several hours before releasing her. Miss Ferreira's mother never reported the incident to police, end quote. Really, it's just kind of a weird and horrifying aside in all of this. Ms. Ferreira, for her part, has lived in the United States since the mid-1980s, when she entered as a tourist. She has been living in the United States without authorization for nearly four decades. She told her sisters about the experience with the uncle not long after she entered the United States. Seems like she may have fraudulently tried to get a U.S. passport because she was convicted of that and DHS commenced removal proceedings. She applied for asylum and related relief, but later it really only became about withholding removal under the INA. As the basis, the particular social groups that she claimed were, one, quote, Trinidadian women who oppose Trinidad's social norms in that they do not want to be subjected to abuse or violent sexual abuse by family members or significant others based on their gender, end quote. And two, family. The immigration judge believed Ms. Ferreira and held that this abuse, suffered as a child, recall, rose to the level of past persecution. But it wasn't on account of one of those two reasons, reasoned the IJ. Also, the IJ didn't believe that either were valid particular social groups anyway. This appears to be in between the matter of LEA decisions that complicated family-based particular social groups bigly. The BIA affirmed, but then changed its mind a little bit on an agreed-upon remand as regards the family-based particular social group. Critically, though, the BIA framed Ms. Ferreira's first particular social group as, quote, women who are subjected to and oppose gender-based violence, end quote. Then the BIA held that that wasn't a particular social group for various reasons. The BIA also didn't think that family membership was a reason for the persecution. Then, quote, the BIA declined to address any other particular social groups offered for the first time on appeal, citing matter of WYC and HOB, end quote. Under that case, of course, non-citizens must proffer all asserted particular social groups before the immigration judge, and the BIA can't then consider new particular social groups proffered for the first time on appeal. But it was the BIA that violated this rule, said the First Circuit. Specifically, it was the BIA that, quote, did not accurately represent Ms. Ferreira's articulated particular social group, end quote. So when it went through and rejected that group's particularity and social distinction, It was doing so of a phantom particular social group, and that was plainly wrong, because it wasn't even the particular social group that Miss Ferreira had proffered. And it was material. The two particular social groups, read side by side, show that the BIA, quote, imposed an additional condition that the women in the particular social group also must be survivors of gender-based violence, end quote. And it was this addition that appears to have heavily influenced the BIA to deem that particular social group impermissibly circularly defined. But Ms. Ferreira never included that portion of the particular social group. The BIA did. As such, the case is going back for the BIA to adjudicate whether there was a nexus to the harm Ms. Ferreira suffered on account of her actual proffered particular social group, again, Trinidadian women who oppose Trinidad's social norms in that they do not want to be subjected to abuse or violent sexual abuse by family members or significant others based on their gender. The First Circuit didn't see a family-based claim, though, or at least it didn't overturn the agency. To satisfy that, in the First Circuit, the family membership, quote, must be at the root of the persecution, so that family membership itself brings about the persecutorial conduct, end quote. Not the case here, said the court. To the First Circuit, even Ms. Ferreira didn't testify that that was the case, rather than just her uncle being a big old sicko. Lots and lots and lots of arguments dispensed with on this, but that's the gist. Nor was there real evidence that Ms. Ferreira would suffer a similar fate in the future, returning back after all these years, as she didn't even know whether her uncle was alive or not. That being said, at the very end of the decision, the First Circuit says that the BIA may need to also consider whether Ms. Ferreira is due withholding of removal based on her membership in the group of Trinidadian women. We'll see what happens on remand. By the way, for those of you who are paying attention to the Sixth Circuit decision I just discussed, it is the case that under BIA precedent, and in the First Circuit for sure, quote, the BIA does have an obligation to review de novo the IJ's ultimate nexus conclusion in light of the arguments presented by a petitioner, end quote. So the First Circuit appears to have addressed what I was querying in the Sixth Circuit decision just now, issued after I recorded the Sixth Circuit case summary. The planets were clearly aligned this week. Need I say more? Please say no. It of course means big congrats to Sang-Yup Kim and Giles Bissonetti from ACLU New Hampshire, along with a whole heap of folks from Ropes and Gray and the Harvard Immigration and Refugee Clinical Program on Amicus, which appears to have included the roundtable of former IJs and BIA members. And I see you in the footnotes pushing the different asylum and withholding of removal standards, Sang-Yup. And that is Ferreira v. Garland. Are you tired of answering your own phones or of wasting your valuable time on unqualified consultations? Staffy Live is the only 24/7 live receptionist and intake service specialized on immigration law. Staffy Live specialists are highly empathetic, bilingual individuals who know how to deal with adversity, have a background in client care, and are trained to qualify callers by asking the right questions. Staffy Live goes one step ahead in only scheduling qualified consultations on your calendar and then doing follow-ups when needed. Staffy Live is giving a 15-day free trial for any law firm interested with no strings attached. To apply, visit www.getstaffy.com. That's GETSTAFI.com. And click on Get Started. Make sure to put in the code FREE. Links, of course, in the show notes. This podcast is sponsored by Driftwood Capital. Driftwood Capital boasts a 30-plus year track record, transacting on more than $3 billion in hospitality assets. Since 2015, Driftwood Capital has successfully implemented the EB-5 program into their development deals, helping more than 160 families find a secure path to residency through their projects. Driftwood Capital is a vertically integrated commercial real estate firm specializing in hospitality with dedicated acquisitions, development, lending, and management divisions. Their goal is to create long-term partnerships with its network of more than 1,200 active investors from the United States and abroad while targeting attractive returns.
Driftwood's unique approach involves managing all aspects in-house, from developing renowned hotel brands such as Marriott, Hilton, and Hyatt, to managing their portfolio of more than 80 hotels in the United States. If you want to learn more about Driftwood Capital, check out the show notes. And of course, let them know who sent you.
We all know the immense dedication that it takes to be an immigration lawyer. You fight tirelessly for your clients, their families, and their future. But let's face it, the administrative side of running a practice can feel overwhelming. Mountains of paperwork, endless calls, juggling deadlines, it can steal your focus and leave you feeling burnt out. But what if there was a way to simplify all of it? I want to tell you about Filevine, a legal case management platform specifically designed by lawyers for lawyers. Filevine keeps all case information centralized in one place. Its immigration-specific tool, Immigration AI, uses the most advanced AI-powered technology to extract vital information from passports, birth certificates, and other essential documents, and automates USCIS form filling through smart questionnaires available in up to 170 languages. Pretty impressive. Filevine and Immigration AI can give you back precious time and energy, allowing you to focus on what matters most, your clients and their cases. So, if you're ready to reclaim your time and rediscover the joy of practicing immigration law, head over to immigration.ai/immigration review.
Next up, from the road, is Borjas Cruz v. Garland, published by the Seventh Circuit on March 21st, 2024. This case is about nexus. Ms. Borjas Cruz and her minor son are from Honduras. She opened a food and clothing store in that country in 2016, but shortly after opening began to get extorted by criminals. She complied initially out of fear for her safety. But as it happens with extortionists, the amounts demanded increased, as did the threats. They were a gang, and they threatened to kill Ms. Borjas Cruz and her family to, quote, clean the house, end quote, if she didn't comply or if she told police. She and her son fled to a town 3 hours away, but the aunt that they lived with in that town got scared herself and said that they could no longer stay. So they fled to the United States. An asylum claim was brought on this basis, but suffice it to say, the immigration judge said that this was more about criminal-minded extortionists rather than persecution on account of one of the five protected grounds. The BIA and the Seventh Circuit agreed. The Seventh Circuit assumed, but did not decide, that one of the proffered groups was a cognizable particular social group. That is, quote, Honduran female business owners who refuse to cooperate with gangs, Honduran women living alone who oppose gang violence, and or women in Honduras, end quote. But the court, like the BIA, didn't believe Ms. Borjas Cruz's membership in one of those groups, even if a group, was one central reason for the harm that she suffered or the persecution that she feared. Didn't help that in Melnick v. Sessions, a Seventh Circuit decision from 2018, the court affirmed the BIA's finding in that case that there was no nexus between those petitioners' proffered group of, quote, small business owners, end quote, in Ukraine, and a fear of persecution. As in that case, the Seventh Circuit didn't see any evidence indicating that the extortionists were targeting them because of an animus towards business owners. To the Seventh Circuit, then, Melnick, quote, makes a key point. In a case involving extortion, the petitioner must show that the persecutor had some motivation to target the social group at issue beyond the mere desire to obtain money, end quote. Restated, it's totally possible, and mixed motive cases are viable when extortion demands are present. Just not established here. To the Seventh Circuit, all of the evidence showed that it was a gang interested solely in money and targeting Ms. Borjas Cruz for that reason. That some country condition evidence might show that women in Honduras are targeted more often than men because of perceived vulnerability was too generalized of evidence standing alone to establish the required nexus showing. The Seventh Circuit doesn't seem to really like the IJ's alternative finding that Ms. Borjas Cruz could safely and reasonably relocate in Honduras, but it doesn't really matter if she can't show a nexus to a protected ground for her fears, explained the court. So the Seventh Circuit affirmed the removal order. And that is Borjas Cruz v. Garland. Also from The Road, we have Sing V. Garland, published by the Ninth Circuit on March 22, 2024. This case is about reasonable relocation. Judge Van Dyke dissented. We've seen quite a few cases like this of late. Mr. Sing is a Sikh supporter of the Man Party, quote, which advocates for the creation of a sovereign state for Sikh people. Two of India's major political parties, the BJP and the Badal Party, oppose the Man Party, end quote. During his asylum testimony in immigration court, Mr. Sing reported that he was subject to attacks in 2014 and 2015. Attacks and death threats from both BJP and Badal operatives due to his work for the Man Party. Police refused his request to even file complaints against the BJP party, a party that I believe governed India at the time, and it does today. The second attack was even worse than the first attack. Pretty rough, as Mr. Sing reported. Quote, he spent one day in the hospital, then lived in hiding with his grandparents for several weeks before fleeing India. After Mr. Sing left India, his family told him that BJP and Badal party members harassed Mr. Singh's family and inquired about his whereabouts. Members of the BJP and Badal party had previously harassed Mr. Singh's father, a Man Party member, before he died, end quote. Mr. Sing testified in court that he couldn't relocate in India, which to be fair is quite a large country, for a variety of reasons. For example, BJP is everywhere, he explained, and they target Man Party supporters everywhere. Moreover, he does not have any relatives who live outside of Punjab state, and he does not speak Hindi, the predominant language outside of Punjab in India. The immigration judge didn't believe the two beatings and the threats amounted to past persecution. As such, Mr. Singh had the burden to show that his fear of persecution in the future is well-founded and that he can't relocate in India to avoid it. Unmet, reasoned the immigration judge. Similar, but not identical, rationale on cat protection. The BIA affirmed. Crucially, however, after agreeing that Mr. Sing hadn't established a past persecution showing, the BIA assumed, in the alternative, that he had, and then held that he hadn't met his burden to establish that relocation wasn't safe and reasonable. But as longtime podcast listeners know, that's a possible error. If you're assuming past persecution, it's DHS's burden to establish that relocation is reasonable, not the non-citizens to establish that it's not. And that's pretty much what resulted in a remand by the Ninth Circuit majority here. Because, quote, after comparing the facts of Mr. Singh's case with those of similar cases, we conclude that the record compels the conclusion that the harm Mr. Singh suffered rose to the level of persecution, end quote. So now the IJ and BIA's decision is on shaky ground. In support of this past persecution showing, the Ninth Circuit relies on its precedent decision in none other than Sing V. Garland from 2022, episode 125, and one of at least two Sing V. Garland decisions published by the Ninth Circuit alone in 2022 alone. Very similar facts here to that other Sing. A Man Party claim. Forced to flee his home and live in hiding. Repeated death threats, some physical beatings, and repeated at that, four separate encounters to be specific here. Threats to family members, all in the context of a Man Party BJP conflict that is occurring in Punjab, explained the Ninth Circuit. Extensive evidence submitted on that point, noted the court. If you've got a similar case, here's your roadmap. The Ninth Circuit doesn't require a showing of extensive medical treatment to establish a past persecution claim. Indeed, it does not even, quote, require severe injuries to meet the serious harm prong of the past persecution analysis, end quote. The Ninth Circuit also went on to distinguish some of its old past persecution case law that OIL often relies on in cases like this, so peek this decision for arguments against those decisions as well, no matter the country that your client hails from. And so again, with past persecution essentially found by the Ninth Circuit, it means that DHS bears the burden on relocation, something that the BIA seems to have been trying to get in front of in the alternative in its decision by saying that the record showed that relocation was in fact possible. But the problem is, the BIA messed up on burdens. And I mean, anyway, how could the BIA hold that DHS had met its burden below when the IJ never held DHS to that burden? The BIA then compounded the mistake, explained the Ninth Circuit, quote, by failing to conduct a reasoned analysis with respect to Mr. Singh's individualized situation to determine if he could safely relocate within another area of India, end quote. DHS needs to point to a specific area of India and prove why relocation there specifically is safe and reasonable, it would seem. For this proposition, the Ninth Circuit cites to a Singh v. Whitaker decision from even earlier. Lots of published Singh decisions in the Ninth Circuit and throughout the courts. Here's a big quote. For DHS to meet its burden on relocation for Indian man party type claims, quote, "It is not enough to show that Punjabi police or other actors are unlikely to follow Mr. Singh outside of Punjab because he is a low-level Man Party member and not a high-profile militant," end quote. That's kind of a big deal. The Ninth Circuit affirmed the denial of cat protection, though. And by the way, Ninth Circuit warriors, the panel recognized that it remains an open question in the Ninth Circuit whether it applies de novo review or deferential substantial evidence review to determine, quote, whether particular acts constitute persecution for purposes of asylum, end quote. Dare I say Wilkinson implies de novo? Dare me. Judge Van Dyke dissented, writing that, quote, "I will say it again. This is not how we should be reviewing the agency's decisions," end quote. But I will say that it means congratulations, Ina Lipkin, for petitioner. And that is Singh v. Garland.
Concluding with a long one from the Ninth Circuit. Tapia Correa v. Garland, published by the Ninth on March 19th, 2024. This case, like the Supreme Court's, is also about jurisdiction, but a different provision, and the scope of the Supreme Court's recent Nasrallah decision. Ms. Tapia Correa is from Mexico and became a lawful permanent resident in 1990 after having lived here since 1982. Probably an amnesty beneficiary. Should have naturalized, didn't. Convicted of possession for sale of methamphetamine in 1999. Spent 6 months in jail. She's been here ever since. She never lost her green card. But she traveled to Mexico in 2015, and at the border, CBP treated her as an arriving alien due to her 16-year-old controlled substance conviction. This was because CBP believed that the conviction was both a violation of a law relating to a controlled substance, and quite frankly, even worse, that there was reason to believe that she is or has been a drug dealer. Two different inadmissibility provisions that can permit CBP to treat a returning LPR as an applicant for admission, and with big consequences. If detained, for example, she cannot even get a bond hearing before an IJ, while DHS litigates her removal under Section 212 of the INA rather than Section 237. That if it was 237 would place more of a burden on DHS and would generally have been better for relief application eligibility. Seems though, like Ms. Tapia Correa, applied for cancellation of removal for LPRs but was denied. The IJ ordered her removed. Unsure if she was in detention. On appeal, Ms. Tapia Correa filed a motion to remand based on the fact that her husband had been the victim of a crime and had helped law enforcement and had a U visa application pending, making her a derivative spouse on that application. Now, that application was only pending, it was not approved yet. Plus, due to her conviction, she needed a waiver to even benefit once it was approved, which she submitted with the U visa application in the motion to remand request. The BIA denied everything, including an alternative motion for administrative closure to await resolution of the U visa matter with USCIS. Ms. Tapia Correa petitioned for review the BIA's denial of her motion to remand and administratively close the case. That's what's at the Ninth Circuit. She didn't challenge the denial of relief. Difficult challenge to win on the merits, to be sure. And here, well, the Ninth Circuit held it couldn't review any of it. All because of a conviction with a 6-month imprisonment from 1999. This is a long one, as I mentioned, and it's a dense decision on jurisdiction. And after last week's monstrosity of an episode, I'm gonna do my best to cut to the chase, but it's not easy. This case is about that other jurisdiction-stripping provision, different than the two at issue in the Supreme Court case. This is INA Section 242A2C. But that's also the precise statute that was at issue in the Supreme Court's Nasrallah decision a few terms ago. Under that jurisdiction-stripping provision, quote, "No court shall have jurisdiction to review any final order of removal against a non-citizen who is removable by reason of having committed a covered criminal offense," end quote. Ms. Tapia's drug conviction is a covered offense, but she's not seeking removal of a final order of removal per se. She's seeking review of the denial of a motion to remand and or administratively close her case. True, a final order of removal exists because the BIA dismissed her appeal, but she's not challenging that final order of removal per se. A lot of the Ninth Circuit's rationale here regards Nasrallah. Despite Section 242A2C in Nasrallah, the Supreme Court held that circuits, quote, can review factual findings underlying the denial of Convention Against Torture protection, end quote, because denial of CAT protection is separate from the final order of removal itself. CAT is simply seeking to withhold or defer execution of a final order, which nonetheless remains final. Even though the denial of CAT protection is reviewed alongside the review of the final order of removal itself, procedurally. To the Ninth Circuit, though, the Nasrallah Court held that in the non-CAT context, quote, a final order of removal includes all rulings of an IJ or the BIA that merge into final orders of removal, end quote. So, like evidentiary rulings that the IJ does before issuing the final order of removal, that sort of thing. Using this logic, the Ninth Circuit held that in asking the Ninth to review the denial of a motion to remand and administratively close, Ms. Tapia Correa was asking the court to review something that, quote, would affect the validity of the final order of removal or disturb that final order of removal, end quote, and that such a thing is therefore encompassed and precluded by Section 242A2C. U visa relief, if granted, would also, of course, preclude her removal, reasoned the Ninth Circuit. In so holding, the Ninth Circuit expressly disagrees with the Fourth Circuit's recent decision in Williams v. Garland, episode 134. Will the Ninth Circuit employ similar logic to begin denying motions to reopen where the non-citizen has a disqualifying criminal history? Do they already? Unsure. But if not, that would seem like the more impactful thing to hold or to logically imply from this decision, given the amount of motions to reopen denial petitions for review that exist, and would seem exactly what's getting queued up. After all, the Ninth Circuit says that a motion to remand is, quote, analogous, end quote, to a motion to reopen multiple times in this decision, and points to its pre-IRIRA decision, Sarmati, in support, which involved motions to reopen. Note, importantly here, there is no real argument that Section 242A2D accepts this jurisdiction-stripping provision. There is no question of law at issue in this case. But there is another exception in the Ninth Circuit to Section 242A2C, jurisdiction barring. The, quote, on-the-merits exception, end quote. It seems like it's a special Ninth Circuit rule. How does it work? Quote, for example, when an IJ denies statutory withholding of removal on the ground that the petitioner was ineligible for that relief because he had been convicted of a particularly serious crime, we have held that we lack jurisdiction under the criminal alien bar. But if the IJ had denied this relief for reasons other than the crime underlying the petitioner's removability, such as a lack of likely persecution, then we would have had jurisdiction to review the IJ's factual findings, which would be considered findings on the merits, end quote. That is, if it's not the criminal thing directly at issue, the Ninth Circuit has held 242A2C doesn't bar review of factual findings. Now, this panel doesn't appear to agree with this Ninth Circuit on the merits exception, but if it applies, the court recognizes that Ms. Tapia Correa would meet it. After all, the BIA didn't deny the motion to remand or motion to administratively close because she was somehow disqualified because of her criminal conviction. Which led the Ninth Circuit to issue their bombshell. Nasrallah implicitly overruled the Ninth Circuit's on-the-merits exception to Section 242A2C jurisdiction stripping. That is a big deal, and I don't see how an en banc challenge isn't attempted. Because, after all, quote, Nasrallah, of course, did not directly address the on-the-merits exception, end quote. Indeed, it did not even mention it. And Nasrallah expanded circuit court jurisdiction. It didn't contract it. End quote. The Supreme Court in Nasrallah described the issue before it as a narrow one, end quote. But under Ninth Circuit law, quote, where the reasoning or theory of our prior circuit authority is clearly irreconcilable with the reasoning or theory of intervening higher authority, a three-judge panel should consider itself bound by the later and controlling authority and should reject the prior circuit opinion as having been effectively overruled, end quote. And that's what the panel sees is its duty here. Unlike the on-the-merits exception, the panel sees the Supreme Court's view of Section 242A2C in Nasrallah as, quote, crystal clear. The Court of Appeals may not review factual challenges to a final order of removal, end quote. Big bad jurisdiction-stripping decision from the Ninth Circuit. Again, can't imagine we don't see this guy in some form back again in the coming months. But for now, it meant that Ms. Tapia Correa lost her case and gets no review. Gotta note, as the circuit court watcher that I have become. Just 3 weeks ago, in Edwards v. Attorney General of the United States, published by the 11th Circuit, on panel rehearing, the 11th Circuit refused to similarly extend what is clearly even clearer logic in Nasrallah to permit review of factual findings underlying the denial of withholding of removal under the INA, which is also, of course, separate from a final order of removal like cat protection, but was not, of course, directly at issue in Nasrallah itself. Nevertheless, the 11th Circuit there believed itself bound by its prior precedent that it couldn't review the facts underlying a denial of withholding of removal, where the non-citizen had a disqualifying crime. And that is Tapia Correa v. Garland.
So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review, or send us a tweet at imreview, that's I-M-M, review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.